Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 57. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we jump into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so grateful for your immense generosity. A full list of patrons is available on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. November's prize is a copy of The Raven's Widow, a novel of Jane Boleyn by Adrian Dillard. A huge thank you to Adrian for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Thomas Wolsey's downfall is Dr. Daniel Gosling. Dr. Gosling is the early modern legal records specialist at the National Archives. His PhD, completed in 2016 at the University of Leeds, focused on the history of primeniri, the offence that would ultimately bring down Thomas Wolsey. He has an interest in legal jurisdiction and education, and his current research ranges from the early Tudor court of Star Chamber to the Inns of Court regicides. Our conversation is coming straight up after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors. Daniel, how are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And thank you for agreeing to talk Tudors with me. So I thought we could start by you just introducing yourself and telling our listeners a little bit about your background.
Yeah, of course. I'm Dan Gosling. I'm the early modern legal record specialist at the UK National Archives. Before that, I worked at the archives of the Honourable Society of Gray's Inn, one of the Inns of Court in London. And that's where I was when I finished my PhD, which was at the University of Leeds, and I finished that in 2016. My specialisms are legal history, sort of late medieval, early modern, looking at legal jurisdiction, legal education, and legal interpretation.
Okay, and when did you first become interested in Tudor history in particular?
Like most English school kids, I was taught the Tudors at school, and it stayed with me. I ended up learning it as well at university. So at school, I actually did the Rise of Wolsey and also the reigns of Edward and Mary. And then when I was at university, at Royal Holloway, University of London, I looked at the Tudors generally and also Tudor queenship of Mary and Elizabeth.
Okay, now you've mentioned that you're the early modern legal record specialist, hopefully I got that right, at the National Archives. So what does that role actually involve?
Yeah, it's quite a mouthful. So I'm in the early modern team. My period is very broadly sort of 1450 to 1750. And though I'm not a lawyer or a legal historian sort of by experience, I used a lot of legal records in the past. So what my job is basically people coming in that want to use these legal records or are interested in these legal records, I try and sort of help them through it and actually decipher the jargon, because they can be quite intimidating to sort of a new researcher.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we talk about Thomas Wolsey's downfall, which is what we're kind of going to focus on, it would be really great if you could give us a little background information on Wolsey. What do we know of his early life and his family, that sort of thing?
Yeah, of course. Wolsey, were it not for his spectacular downfall, would actually have been one of the great Tudor success stories, because he had really humble origins. So he was born in Ipswich in the early 1470s to Robert Wolsey and Robert Wolsey's wife, Joan Daundy. Robert was an innkeeper in the 1460s, early 1470s, and then went on to become a butcher in Ipswich. So later on, when Thomas Wolsey's at his height, his critics and rivals actually use his humble origins as sort of a negative against him and say he shouldn't be as high as he is because he comes from such low origins. From Ipswich, he went to school in Ipswich and then moved to Oxford, and he studied at Magdalene College, Oxford. He actually got his BA in 1486 at the age of 15, so he got the nickname the Boy Bachelor. We know this from Wolsey's official biographer, George Cavendish, who was an usher of Wolsey.
Okay, so I've definitely, the son of a butcher I've heard lots of times, but I haven't actually heard the Boy Bachelor, so that's interesting.
Boy Bachelor, I think we get this from George Cavendish. As I said, George Cavendish is the person that wrote the biography of Wolsey. He actually served as gentleman usher of Wolsey, but wrote the biography about 20, 30 years after Wolsey's death and downfall. So it's a bit of a panegyric. It's saying how wonderful Wolsey is, but also this stuff like Wolsey's early childhood and early life has definitely come from Wolsey's mouth dictating to Cavendish. So we have to take it a bit of a pinch of salt, but it seems like a nickname that he could have adopted.
Okay, so you mentioned his kind of humble beginnings. So when does Wolsey first come to court, and in what capacity?
Well, so yeah, he was being educated for a career in the church. So he was at Oxford and he studied and got his BA, he got his MA. By 1500, it looks like he leaves Oxford. And by 1502, he enters the service of Henry Dean, the Archbishop of Canterbury, as Henry Dean's chaplain. Henry Dean dies a year later in 1503. And Wolsey then moves over to the service of Richard Nanfan, who is Treasurer of Calais. And then Richard Nanfan dies in 1507. And according to Cavendish, as part of sort of Richard Nanfan's will, he suggests that Wolsey join the royal household. We don't know if this is true, but we do know that in 1507, after Richard Nanfan dies, Wolsey joined the household of Henry VII as Henry VII's royal chaplain. So he's in the royal household by 1507 under Henry VII.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I don't know if sort of a lot of people realise that he actually did start off with Henry VII and then moved, obviously, when Henry VIII came to the throne. So that's really interesting. So let's talk a little bit about Wolsey's rise to power under Henry VIII. How did it come about, and why was he so indispensable to the king?
Okay, so yeah, when Henry VII died and Henry VIII succeeded him, Wolsey had been in the royal household for nearly 2 years by that point. So he knew how the royal household worked. He knew how the Privy Council worked. He was quite close, or stayed quite close, with Henry VII's Privy Councillors. So when Henry VIII came to the throne, he already knew how best to please a Tudor king. What Wolsey does quite quickly. By November 1509, he is promoted to Henry VIII's royal almoner, which gives him a place on the Privy Council. And on the Privy Council, Wolsey can obviously dictate policy, royal policy, and debate royal policy with the other councillors. Why Wolsey, or how Wolsey, becomes indispensable to the king over other councillors? It seems that Wolsey recognises quite early on. I mean, when Henry VIII comes to the throne, he's only 17. He's not far off his 18th birthday. And if you know any 17, 18-year-olds, they don't really want to do the quite boring administrative ruling. And Wolsey recognised this and said, OK, great, I'm very good at this diplomacy, at this administration. I'm happy to do it. So he does that so that Henry can get on with what he enjoys. And Henry lets him because it means he doesn't have to do it.
Right, yeah, that makes sense. So I want to talk a little bit about sort of the early church reform, because I know Wolsey was involved in this in the sort of, you know, 1520s, late 1520s. Can you talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So by 1515, Wolsey is made cardinal, and he's Archbishop of York by that point as well. And then in 1518, he's made a papal legate, which gives him quite extraordinary powers in England. Their powers, they are limited powers, but it means that he can drive church reform in England. And in fact, the papal legateship keeps getting extended because Henry keeps arguing if the Pope wants papal reform, or if Pope wants church reform in England, the best way to do this is to keep Wolsey on as legate. Just after becoming papal legate in 1518, Wolsey summons the bishops of England to discuss church reform. We said it's to discuss church reform. We don't actually know an awful lot about the meeting, other than Wolsey wanted to talk about church reform. And the things that were talked about there seem to be very common sort of complaints and articles of reform that are throughout the 15th century and early 16th century. So bishops and clerics dressing too ostentatiously or having wives and children, which was seen as a negative. Churchmen should be humble and they shouldn't dress ostentatiously. So this seems to be what Wolsey was talking about, church reform. The problem is Wolsey was actually one of the worst people for this. He was incredibly ostentatious with his wealth, how he dressed. He did have illegitimate children. Thomas Winter is famously his son, who he kept very well throughout Wolsey's lifetime.
And I believe he also had a daughter, didn't he?
He did. His daughter was called Dorothy and became a nun at Shaftesbury.
Yeah, interesting. And I think, am I right in thinking that he did, in fact, in a way, dissolve some minor monasteries in order to fund some colleges of his? Is that right?
He did, yes. So Wolsey endowed a lot of buildings and colleges. The two sort of most famous are he endowed a school at Ipswich, which was Cardinal School in Ipswich, so where he went to school. And then he endowed a college at Oxford, which became Cardinal's College, Oxford, and actually now survives in a form as Christ Church College, Oxford. But to build these and to endow these colleges, he needed money. So what he did, he got a papal dispensation to dissolve a whole lot of monasteries to get that money.
Interesting. Okay. Now, a meteoric rise to power at the Tudor court so often came with an equally spectacular fall from grace, which is what happened to Wolsey. So where did it all go wrong for him?
We're not sure of the exact reason. Yeah. There's a few. I mean, the main reason is that he fell out of Henry VIII's favour. Wolsey's position in England, in church, in politics, was completely down to Henry VIII. So as soon as Henry VIII didn't want him there anymore, he was very susceptible to falling from grace in the way that he did. But there are other reasons. So when Wolsey first becomes cardinal in 1515, it's very much just Wolsey and the king driving royal policy. And this is probably the case for at least 5 years, about 1515 to 1520. 1520 is obviously Field of the Cloth of Gold, which is a spectacular event held between Francis I of France and Henry VIII of England, which Wolsey had a hand in organising and was a massive display of wealth and was seen as one of Wolsey's greatest successes. But what starts to happen in the early 1520s, and certainly by 1525, is Henry starts to rely on other councillors. Not as much as he relied on Wolsey, but Wolsey was obviously used to doing everything himself. And suddenly there are these other councillors coming in that also want the king's time, a bit of influence, a bit of power, and Wolsey's monopolizing it. So he does generate resentment among these councillors, and there are rivalries within the court.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm just thinking, interesting the parallels with like the fall of Cromwell later and that sort of thing. It's just, yeah, once Henry removes his favour, it was quite a dangerous thing, wasn't it?
Oh, I do wonder if Henry did this all intentionally, just to make everyone sort of strive for power and fight over each other, just to, so they remembered who was boss.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so on the 17th of October, 1529, Thomas Wolsey surrenders his seal of office, and then on the 22nd of October, he pleads guilty to the charge of praemunire and was now at the mercy of Henry VIII. So can you explain this term that I can hardly pronounce, praemunire? What does it actually mean?
Yeah, of course. So the praemunire was the offence which I did my PhD on, so I've had to say it an awful lot of times, and I don't know if I'm saying it right anymore. Wolsey had an incredibly bad October, 1529. I will go at length into praemunire later, but I think we just need to talk a little bit about this October. So the 9th of October is when the King's Bench action first starts against him. Very shortly after that, Wolsey writes a letter to the King basically begging forgiveness, even though he's probably not even sure what he's been accused of. And then, as you said, on the 17th of October, he surrenders the seal. Although I've been doing a little research into this, and some people say 17th of October, some say 18th of October, and I've been trying to figure out which is right. It looks like what happens is on the 17th of October, the order is made for Wolsey to surrender the Great Seal, and then Norfolk and Suffolk go to collect it from York Place, which is in London, which is now Whitehall, or where Whitehall is. And some people suggest Wolsey actually refuses to surrender the Great Seal at that point because they don't have the relevant paperwork. So they have to come back the next day when he actually begrudgingly gives it up. So that's my best guess for why we've got the 17th and the 18th as two sort of separate dates for it. But we've definitely got the order for him to surrender the seal on the 17th of October, and he definitely didn't have it by the 18th. So at some point during those 2 days, he lost the seal, yeah.
Okay.
And then on the 20th of October, there's another praemunire charge brought against him in King's Bench. And then, as you said, on the 22nd, he formally in writing admits all his guilt to the king, surrenders everything, and basically puts himself at the mercy of Henry VIII. And then on the 30th of October, that's when the King's Bench action ends and finds him guilty of praemunire. But let's backtrack and just try and decipher what on earth praemunire means, and not just a tricky word that's brought up quite a lot. So praemunire was an offence. It was created by three statutes in the 14th century, so under the reign of Edward III, and then the third statute of praemunire is in 1393 under Richard II. By the Tudor period, they're pretty much only using the third statute of praemunire. What it is really, most generally, it's the offence of undermining royal authority. So it made it an offence to, if you had a court case or you brought a court case and you took it to the court of Rome or a court that wasn't one of the king's courts, if that case could be heard in one of the king's courts, then it was a praemunire. So basically you've undermined royal authority,
right, okay,
by taking the case elsewhere. And the text of the statute actually says the court of Rome or elsewhere. So even though they've got the papal curia in mind, it covers all bases. And that also works both ways. So it's also a praemunire if you are a cleric, or even if you're not a cleric, if you're purchasing a papal bull, or if you're receiving a papal bull and then issuing it in England, and that's to the detriment of any royal law or royal authority, again, that's a praemunire, because what you're doing is undermining the king or the queen's authority by bringing in this papal authority into the realm. Lots of interesting. So my PhD was actually looking at what happened between the enactment in the 14th century all the way up to the break with Rome, because you've got a century and a half in between that, and it does lots of very interesting things. So you get a lot of people arguing that if a court case is taken to the ecclesiastical courts in England, then that's a praemunire, because it should be taken to the common law courts of England, because you're undermining royal authority by taking it to a church court. And by the Tudor period, this is starting to be sort of the general interpretation, where they say that anything that isn't the king's court is a praemunire.
Now, you mentioned that on the 30th of October, Wolsey was found guilty, but just to complicate matters, he was then pardoned and permitted to retire to York. So how did Cardinal Wolsey spend his enforced retirement?
Well, it's very interesting. So Woolsey had at this point over a decade of being the most influential person in England, bar the King. And also, I didn't really mention this earlier, Woolsey, for all his many positive traits, he was a really good diplomat, and he seemed to be quite good administratively, sort of acting as Chancellor of Court. He was also incredibly ambitious, seems to be quite vain and ostentatious, and he couldn't retire quietly. So what Henry essentially let him stay Archbishop of York and all the livings of the Archbishop of York. He wasn't earning as much money as he was before his fall, but he wasn't doing too badly. And if he'd stayed up in York and just done what a good archbishop should do without interfering in political affairs, he'd probably be done okay. He would have just retired in quiet. It would have been okay. But what Wolsey tries to do, so one of the main reasons that Wolsey fell out of the king's favour was the king's great matter, his attempt to annul his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, which Wolsey had failed to do. Even after Wolsey's fall, though, he's still negotiating with foreign diplomats to try and secure the king his, well, his, not his divorce, his annulment, his separation from Catherine, try and get the king what he wants. The problem being that by negotiating with foreign diplomats behind the king's back, he is actually, this is a treasonous act. So he's now committing treason to try and get into the king's favour. And that's exactly what happens. So Henry hears that Wolsey's been talking to foreign diplomats who have then been taking it to kings and emperors on the continent. And Henry has no choice but to declare Wolsey guilty of treason. And then on the 4th of November, 1530, so a year after his fall from grace in the Praemunire, he receives his treason charges and he has to come back down to answer those charges.
So even though he was, in a way, trying to help Henry, I suppose, that obviously made no difference.
Yeah, I mean, the stories that come out, so basically there's this story that comes out that what Wolsey's actually trying to do, he's trying to persuade the French to invade England, and basically he's trying to persuade the French and English to be at war with each other on the understanding that Wolsey is then brought back in and smooths everything over,
right,
and Henry sees.
Okay. Yeah.
So Wolsey's trying to orchestrate, these are the stories that Henry is hearing, and it seems like Henry is believing, that Wolsey is trying to orchestrate this big discord between England and the other sort of European nations, and so that he can come in and save the day.
And do you think that's what he was actually doing?
I certainly think that he is talking to diplomats to try and regain favour with Henry. Whether or not he's going as far as essentially inciting war between nations, I'm not sure it would go that far. But I do think Wolsey certainly thought he was the only person that would be able to deal with such conflict. Certainly the only person that was in the king's council at that time.
So you talked about the fact that he's recalled basically to London to answer these charges of high treason. So what happens on the journey? It doesn't go exactly as planned.
Well, not quite, because he dies.
Yes.
he's coming down from York, and he makes it as far as Leicester. So he doesn't actually get very far. It seems like he's travelling very slowly. There's reports that Wolsey's not very well, that he's heartbroken at these treason charges, because all accounts do seem to suggest that Henry and Wolsey were very close. And when Wolsey fell out of the king's favour, even as early as October 1529, we're getting reports that Wolsey is essentially heartbroken. So he's coming down from York on these treason charges. I think he realises that his cause is lost. And he realises that once he makes it down to London, his chances aren't very good. Whether or not they'll actually go through a full treason trial and execute him is up for debate. But certainly he would have been imprisoned and lost what remained of his goods. So yeah, he's on the way to answer these charges. He seems to be heartbroken. His health isn't good. And he dies. So he's never able to answer the treason charges.
And do we know what Henry VIII's response was to his death? Did he, you know, was he upset about it, or what? How did he respond?
Henry seems to express sorrow. Wolsey and he were very close at one time. But yeah, we don't really know sort of King's personal opinion or how close he was to Wolsey or other councillors. But yeah, he's sorry. Wolsey's death, but it probably solved a lot of problems for the king that Wolsey was now out of the picture.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So the $1 million question, or maybe $1 billion question, Dan, who do you think, or what do you think, was ultimately responsible for Woolsey's downfall? Do you think it was Woolsey himself? You know, you've mentioned he had many positive sides, but his vanity obviously maybe got in the way. Do you think it was Henry VIII? Could it have been the so-called Boleyn faction that people, you know, kind of talk about?
Well, the Boleyn faction is probably the most popular opinion amongst historians and the general public. The Boleyn faction is basically, there are some close royal councillors that rally around Anne Boleyn in the after about 1525, when Anne starts to gain all of this influence around Henry VIII. They see a chance to topple Wolsey by, because they know that Anne's got the king's ears, so they think that if they feed sort of misinformation or negative things about Wolsey to Anne, that will get to Henry, and then Henry will start to doubt his former favourite minister. So this is one of the most popular opinions. The councillors involved are the Dukes of Norfolk and Suffolk. So Thomas Howard is actually Anne's uncle, and then Charles Brandon, the Duke of Suffolk, was formerly Henry VIII's brother-in-law because he married Henry's sister. Whether or not I believe this is the case, I think there are aspects of that. I don't think there is an official faction. The problem is that these sort of secret cabals don't really leave paper trails. So we haven't got any letters that say, yes, we're going to get rid of Wolsey and we're going to rally around Anne Boleyn to do this. But as I said, what I think is happening is Wolsey gets very used to being the king's favourite and the king's only man to get stuff done. From about 1515, him and Wolsey and the king are directing royal policy and basically telling the rest of the Privy Council this is how it's going to go. In the 1520s, this stops happening and Henry starts to bring in other councillors. Also, Henry's getting older, so probably wants to take on a bit more of this sort of kingship and administration himself. I mean, yes, he still loves warfare and he still loves, you know, women and jousting, but he may be getting more of an interest in sort of the administration and wanting to bring more people in. Wolsey is obviously not used to that sort of management. So in 1525, he has multiple failures. 1525, we've got the amicable grant, which was a tax and a subsidy, which Wolsey tried to basically levy himself without parliament, and there were riots across the country. And Wolsey's largely blamed for that. It wasn't just Wolsey, but Wolsey's trying to do things in the same way that he had been doing in the 1510s, and it just wasn't working in the 1520s anymore. And then when it comes to the King's Great Matter, I think Wolsey, by this point, he's already lost sort of his... He's no longer as respected... Or, that's the wrong word. He's no longer as favoured with Henry VIII. Henry VIII has other councillors that he relies on. Anne Boleyn is in the picture at this point. So Wolsey, I think, sees the King's Great Matter as sort of a last chance to redeem himself and to show how he is the best person for Henry VIII. So the fact that that fails, I think that is the straw that broke the camel's back in a way. Once he's failed in the Great Matter, it's basically up to Henry VIII how he disposes of Wolsey. So I think that's really his downfall. But I think it comes about from Wolsey being used to operating in a certain way, and by the mid-1520s, this just isn't the way of things in the King's Council anymore.
We have a question from one of our listeners. So Jen wants to know, Dan, whether you feel that things, and you've kind of touched on this a little bit here, whether you feel that things would have ended differently for Wolsey had he secured the King's annulment, and you kind of have said yes, but how do you feel that Wolsey's survival might have affected the unfolding of the Reformation, is what Jen would like to know.
It's a really good question, because as I said, Wolsey's failure in the Great Matter, Henry basically needed to get rid of him at that point. He couldn't keep him on without losing sort of credibility himself, Henry losing credibility himself. But one of the sort of repercussions of Wolsey's praemunire is Wolsey was accused of obtaining his legateship from the Pope without the king's authority or permission. So when Wolsey was found guilty, it meant that Wolsey's entire legateship was now illegal. And that's what Henry uses in 1530 and in the run-up to the break with Rome against other churchmen in England. So he uses it against the entire convocation in Canterbury and basically says, you were following Wolsey's legatine, now illegal legatine authority over my royal authority, therefore you are all guilty of praemunire unless you pay a massive fine, and end up paying £100,000. So the fact that Wolsey fell opened up all of these doors for Henry to sort of bring the church low in the run-up to what became the break with Rome and the English Reformation. So if Wolsey had succeeded and hadn't fallen, would things have happened the same? I think they would still have gone that way, but I don't think it would have happened as soon, because Wolsey's downfall opened up a lot of doors for Henry in terms of sort of supremacy over the church, which he could have tried to do in the early 1530s. And if Wolsey had still been around, would almost certainly have sided with the king over the church, because regardless of how high up he was in the church, Wolsey always seemed to be a king's man rather than the Pope's man. So yeah, it's a very difficult question. I mean, would things have happened the same way? Probably, but I think it would have taken a bit longer, and I think we'd have seen Wolsey in what sort of became the Cromwell role, the Thomas Cromwell role, in the 1530s.
Well, I think you did very well at answering that very tricky question. Thank you, Jen, for that great question. Now, Dan, the second last thing we do on Talking Tudors is we play a little game of 10 to go. So these are basically 10 questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready for that?
Yes, I'm ready.
So number one, what was the last film that you watched?
Last week, I watched Rocketman, the Elton John biopic, and thought it was fantastic.
Oh, excellent. I haven't seen that, so add that one to the list.
It's done in a very different way. So it's a musical, basically, of John's songs, but also a biopic, which I loved because I love Elton John's songs.
Well, that actually links very nicely with the next question. I was going to ask you, what music do you enjoy? You've told us a bit.
I enjoy quite a broad range of music, actually. But Elton John, I do love singing loudly and badly for everyone to hear. So any song that you can really, sing loudly to, love it.
Excellent. So then I have to ask, do you have a favourite karaoke song?
I mean, it changes day by day, but probably Erasure's A Little Respect. I don't know if you know it.
No, I don't know. Probably if I hear it, I might not. Well, there you go.
There's quite a high note in it, which I would obnoxiously try and sing at whatever time of day or night it is.
So you're one of those people that like rumbles the other person for the karaoke microphone?
Yeah, I'll be like, oh, if you insist, I'll have a sing. Why not?
Love it. Okay, so what is your drink of choice? If a friend's taking you out for a drink, what are you having?
Probably a gin and tonic. Something very dry.
Very nice, very nice. And what's something you love about where you live?
Well, I'm actually moving house tomorrow.
Oh, are you?
So where I'm moving to is going to be next to Richmond Park, which I'm really looking forward to. Just, it would just be a short walk from so much greenery. I mean, I'm not that far from a park now, but compared to Richmond Park, it's nothing really. So I really like the air. I like how close I am to central London if I want to go into London. I also like that there is this greenery a short walk from my house, because otherwise central London can get a bit oppressive.
Now, I was going to ask you, Nate, to name a book that's currently on your bedside table, but maybe it's packed up in a box somewhere already. So what's a book that you're currently reading?
I'm currently reading Ronald Hutton's The Witch. Really, really enjoying it. So it is a history book, but it's sort of aimed at sort of a more popular market, a broader market. But I'm really enjoying it because I know of the witch trials and sort of witches in the early modern period, but it's going in a direction which I really wasn't expecting, and I'm really enjoying it.
So that's a non-fiction?
It's a non-fiction, yeah, but it's written in a really readable way. And as I said, I don't have a in-depth knowledge of witches in sort of the early modern period, so I picked it up. I'm really enjoying it at the moment, yeah.
What is a favourite holiday destination?
I really enjoy going to Glastonbury in England.
Yeah.
So I actually got married there, and it's somewhere that me and my wife have gone lots and lots of times, and it's so peaceful there, and you've got the tour, you've got the old abbey, I really love going there. If we ever go on a short sort of staycation sort of in England, that's a lovely place to go because it's just so relaxing.
Yeah, that sounds good. I haven't been there, but I would like to visit. Describe your ideal Friday night.
It's going to sound dreadfully boring, but probably staying in. staying in and watching a film with a takeaway.
Yeah, that sounds good.
The nights are drawing in at the moment. It's getting very cold. And after a long week, I think that's just ideal.
Yeah, no, that sounds perfect. Now, we are, of course, getting close to good old Christmas, the festive season. So what's a favourite Christmas tradition?
One that's a relatively new tradition for me is me and a few of my friends, we usually go up to London to one of the Christmas markets, usually the ones sort of on the Thames or on the South Bank, something like that. So walk around, see friends that sometimes I haven't seen them for several months or up to a year, and we just catch up, go for sort of a walk around London, because London at Christmas time is lovely. It's all lit up, it's quite cold, you can wrap up warm and have like mulled wines, and that's a really nice tradition that we've been doing the last few years.
Yeah, that sounds really atmospheric. I like that. So when you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I mean, I was quite a boring child, my siblings tell me. And one of the first things I remember wanting to be was an archaeologist, mostly because of the TV show Time Team. So I joined all of these societies like the Young Archaeologist Club and sort of loved digging around in gardens, hoping to find sort of flints and things like that. So I wasn't far off in my career choice, but yeah, didn't quite want to become an archaeologist in the end.
Yeah, no, that's pretty close to your current career choice. I wanted to become an archaeologist after watching Indiana Jones, so that was my...
Indiana Jones. I still maintain I'm as close to Indiana Jones as I can get in my current role.
I love it. All right. So there's so much that obviously still, you know, so many questions about the Tudor period and so much that remains undiscovered. What's a find that you would love to make?
Oh, well, there's so much. I mean, at the moment, one of the things that I'm working on are the records of the Court of Star Chamber, which is one of the courts that was in prominence in the Tudor and Stuart periods. Frustratingly with that court, a large bulk of the records called the Star Chamber Archive was lost in about sort of the late 17th, early 18th century. So if I could find that, or if anyone else could find that, that would be absolutely fantastic, because that would tell us about a huge number of cases that we just don't know about or only know through secondary sources, and would just give us a much greater insight into this court, which was so influential in the early modern period.
Well, Dan, I wish you luck. I hope you find that those boxes of...
Yeah, if anyone out there has them, please let us know.
Yeah, hidden somewhere, exactly in someone's attic or something like that. All right, the very last thing we do is I ask all my listeners if they can give us a Tudor takeaway. So that's something for us to go and check out after the show. You know, it might be a film to watch, book to read, anything like that. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
Yeah, as we've been talking about Wolsey so much, one of the things I did, I gave a talk about Wolsey relatively recently, and one of the things that I did to lighten the mood after talking about all the rather dry legal records is looking at all the different portrayals of Wolsey in film and TV. So I think I'll recommend going to watch A Man for All Seasons, which is obviously the biopic of Thomas More, but Orson Welles plays Wolsey in it, and he's truly monstrous. So yeah, please go and look at that.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. Is he your favourite Wolsey out of all the sort of television Wolseys?
I mean, I don't think he's very close to what Wolsey was like in real life. But in terms of cinematic Wolseys, yeah, he's pretty entertaining and monstrous, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great film. I love that. That's a really good takeaway. And Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk Tudors with me. And I look forward to hearing more about all your exciting research and work that you're doing.
Oh, no problem at all. Thanks for having me.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.